equals burn. The propaganda's win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Welcome to 10200, the Media and Politics podcast. Where are we? Saturday the 14th of June. I probably just need to put dates on stuff more often now because of how quickly the world is moving. So when you hear this a couple of days after it's edited, we don't sound terrifically out of date. I'm joined by my co-host Simone. How are you doing?
Well, Kyle, I got here an hour early and then I was an hour early, and then I went to go and get breakfast because I had time, and then I didn't have breakfast food, and then I went to the supermarket. And then I'd forgotten my wallet, so I came back and I've had neither breakfast nor rest. So that's how I'm doing.
Wonderful. Glad to hear you're on top of your game. Also joined by Josephine. How are you, Josephine?
Kia ora. Well, not very well, to be honest. I've had a week of sleepless nights. I mean, the news is pretty horrific. And, you know, yesterday, for example, I was just so distracted. I could barely work. So this is the reality that we're, you know, living through, a time of turbulence, a time of, you know, global geopolitical shifts. But ultimately, there's a lot of violence. I mean, this is probably the most violent period of colonial violence, you know, in modern history, I would say, that we're living through at the moment. The live stream genocide and this escalating kind of, I don't know, war crisis. So, yeah, other than that, I guess I'm okay.
And gentlemen, guest Jeremy Moses, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Kyle. Pleasure to be here, as always.
How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah, like Josephine. I mean, I find in a way, it's kind of struggling to work, to do the things that we have to do right now in terms of teaching and marking and, you know, writing research papers and things like that. But it also is a pretty important part of our work to be really tuned in to what is actually happening. So, and that's, you know, not even just yesterday. It's like every day there's some major new issue in the world that we need to be aware of and to understand what's going on. And it's really overwhelming. So overwhelmed in a whole range of different ways, but not too bad. You know, can't complain too much.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, we, everyone on this podcast and perhaps a lot of our audience as well are watching these feeds and following this pretty consistently. You know, it's we've got a certain type of demographic, and especially if you're in academia, if you're in media, and, you know, it's part of your role to cover this as well. And I can only like think about how much more discombobulating it is for people who aren't finger on the pulse, right? You know, in the last few days, couple of days, you know, like time is contracting and expanding as these events unfold. But I've been looking at the way in which as this aggression by Israel expands once again to target Iran, the way in which Western media, and particularly New Zealand media, go beyond just coddling their audiences once again to actively propagandizing for the Israeli state, Western imperialism, US hegemony. Just some absurd turns of phrase being used. Some of them you can see have directly come from the Israeli government. You know, they're echoing or parroting exactly the rationale being given by the IDF. And you just have to wonder how difficult must it be for your average, you know, news enjoyer, average consumer, average audience member to grasp and understand the chaos that is unfolding when those of us who are far too deep in it, honestly, speaking for myself here, like I'm just reading too much news. This sucks. When it's difficult for us to engage with.
Yeah, I mean, I've experienced that this teaching over the past semester, you know, coming into class each time, and I may have even said this on a previous time I was on here, every time you come into the class, you have to introduce the students to some new crisis that's taking place, as well as at the end of all of that, giving them some sense of purpose and hope in response to it. For them, with a whole varying range of different levels of engagement as well, you know, generally less than probably what the level that we engage with it, but some of them quite heavily engaged, some of them engaged in protest, others completely detached from it. So yeah, there's a big thing going on there. And I've just been thinking a lot about, how when you talk about propaganda systems and you talk about the responsibility of the media, I was reminded of the old Cold War era joke last week about the Soviet diplomat and the American diplomat coming meeting each other, and the American says, "Oh, we're really impressed by the Soviet propaganda system." And the Soviet guy says to the American, "Oh, likewise, we're really impressed by your propaganda system." And the American says, "What propaganda system?" And I kind of feel like there's a lot of that, like that there are a lot of people who are actually completely unaware that this exists. Like it's so hegemonic, if you want to use the technical term, that people are incapable of recognizing that they are taking a political position on these things. And when you see that today in the German Foreign Office statement, "We strongly condemn the indiscriminate Iranian attack on Israeli territory." I mean, it's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre that they are representing it in that way. I don't know what it does for their credibility. Like, I don't know whether they believe it or not. Like, it's a very weird time to be seeing this stuff playing out.
I just want to call upon Uncle Moana Jackson here. He's talked about this phenomenon of colonial myth-making. And I think this is in play right now. It's in action at the moment. So he's saying that in order for colonial system to exist and continue, it's not enough to have, for example, the power over the territory or something, but it's also dependent upon certain myths that are being made and people agree upon. And one of these myths is, the idea of, Western impartiality, also this, scientific rigor, rational processes, and all these things. And this is so deeply, kind of embedded within the Western psyche that their sources, their narratives are in fact embedded in these rigorous processes. And in fact, this is a myth, and this is why they cannot accept that they are doing propaganda. And I was just remembering today, I was watching, this morning an interview between Sky News and Professor Mohammad Marandi from the University of Tehran, and he kind of touches upon this as well, where he says, you always center the Israeli narrative, and our narratives are always treated with suspicion. Yet the Israeli narrative is just taken at face value, and I don't need to explain this to your audience anymore. Your audience already know this. That's why they don't trust you anymore. But so those shifts are happening. But even then, the West is still, especially the power centers, the establishment, they just deny the possibility that they are, in fact, the biggest propaganda machines on the planet.
Yeah, and it's this really, I don't even know how to assess it just yet, but this divide between, the audiences you're talking about, Josephine, who are watching the news and that trust is kind of slipping, and they're looking elsewhere to try and get like any kind of information about these catastrophic events, about these crises. The divide between them and their political leadership, or the kind of higher classes who have presumably far more access to the actual reality, and yet are acting as if all of these systems of propaganda, all these information systems that have been built up alongside the myth making to help justify and manufacture consent for, like atrocity, like
Genocide,
increasingly, they're acting as if it's still working, as if, and not just working, but like is working at the highest level it's ever been able to. But you put it side by side, even just with, video of what's actually happening, or even sometimes, like we've talked about this before in relation to Gaza, what Israeli media is saying versus what Western media and Western politicians are saying, and the divide is immediately there. The facts are immediately made clear as to maybe not specifically what is happening on the ground, but at least that there is a disagreement about reality.
while yesterday I saw some of your, tweets with the documents, with the receipts about RNZ and how they were trying to frame Israel's attack on Iran. What did you see? What did you find?
I'm just like, I'm already primed to be anti-ready in New Zealand at this point, following the last almost 2 years of, I'm just gonna say straight out lack of coverage of the genocide, in Palestine. Alongside that, the failure to effectively investigate themselves, with just the most absurd justifications given. I think Mick Hall responded to me yesterday, like somewhat sarcastically, to say, "Oh, it's all about proximity, Kyle. They share our values. Israel shares our values, and thus RNZ is required to put forward the Israeli narrative, front and center." Like, this is something that Ready New Zealand literally said in their independent investigation done into their coverage of these issues.
And unexpectedly woke because, New Zealand, former apartheid state, Israel, apartheid state.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, it would be funnier, right? Like, but it is. We do share these values. We share these values with the US. We are a colonial entity. And they've kind of got it right in that sense, but unfortunately it's not what they meant, and they're not going to do anything about it.
Kyle, I just want to point out the first thing that you noted, when the news was just breaking within minutes, was that Radio New Zealand was framing it as a preemptive strike. So this was, this is the beginning of the manufacturing of consent for whatever this belligerent state of Israel is doing. And I think this is one of the key things we want to discuss today, the attack on Iran, the residential areas in Iran, specifically. Specifically, also in Tehran, the capital city.
Yeah, so this is one of those lines which I said was taken basically straight from Israeli PR, right? So this is what they were calling it. They were saying this alongside a little bit of other information and other public relations out there around Iran's nuclear capacity. But it's immediately given the lie to, and intentionally or not, by the fact that Iran recently elected like a moderate to the presidency who actively has been seeking talks with the US to get sanctions lifted and to slow down the nuclear program, like to, I guess, renormalize their relationship with the United States. And Donald Trump was on record as saying, like, we want to have these talks. And like, we don't have to believe Donald Trump, right? He's a, just to be clear, but that was happening. They were going to be having talks about this stuff. And Israel's kind of come in over the top, probably with US involvement, I would say, and probably and definitely with US knowledge. But yeah, as you say, RNZ just picked this up, as did a number of other Western media organizations, to say this is a preemptive strike, mentioned the nuclear thing, like, oh, it's existential for Israel, because, for the last 30 years, I think, Iran has been close to creating a nuclear weapon. And right now is when it was going to happen, which is just bullshit. And a justification of aggression, of a state that has already been trying to start wars by actively attacking its neighbors for the last 2 years, has an ongoing genocide. Nothing these people say should be trusted at this point.
Mick Hall called Radio New Zealand Radio Five Eyes. That's what I remember.
Jeremy, what were
I
you going to
think,
add there?
I mean, I think there's this kind of denial of history as well, not just in the German position where they're saying is Iran's breaching the non-proliferation treaty. I mean, it's like they've forgotten not just the deal between Iran and the United States that Trump got rid of, which was proving to be effective, but also everything prior to that. And Netanyahu has been talking about his desire to attack Iran for a long time. We had that incident with John McCain singing in the tune to Barbara Ann, bomb bomb, bomb Iran. Like, this is a current that has run through Democratic and Republican presidencies, through the neocons and the liberal hawks for decades, that they have wanted to do this. The fact that people thought that Trump was somehow not going to support it, I think, was interesting. I mean, I think it is interesting that Rubio put out the statement saying that no, we're not involved in this. And then a few hours later, Trump put out his Truth Social post, which is absolutely shocking, the language of it, and very little has been made of it so far. People are just like, oh, Trump's trying to say that he was involved in this from a start. But look at the language of it. Certain Iranian hardliners spoke bravely, but they didn't know what was about to happen. They're all dead in capital letters now. They're all dead now, and it will only get worse. There has already been great death and destruction, but there is still time to make this slaughter, with the next already planned attacks being even more brutal, come to an end. I mean, this is psychopathic bloodlust from the president, and people just seem to think that this is. I don't know what they think it is. Like, it's a bizarre, like really bizarre that this is playing out in this way. And people are trying to pretend it's normal. Like this is a state just defending itself against Iran trying to get, I mean, it's crazy. That's crazy. I can't make sense of what people are thinking. I can't make sense of the Germans and the British and the French thinking that their people are going to accept the way in which they're representing and explaining this, or Radio New Zealand, or anyone within this country who thinks that they can present this as Israel's being ganged up on and victimized again. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, I mean, it is really, shocking to see that the way that Trump is describing it. Imagine if this happened to any other, any Western country where the scientists are targeted, for example, or, the key people in the military are targeted and they get away with it. The first term of Trump, he assassinated Qasem Soleimani, one of the generals of the Iranian military, and he was one of the key people fighting ISIS in the region. And this is the thing, right? Like, whenever we see the policies of Israel and the United States, covertly they are supporting the rise of ISIS and these kinds of forces, which Israel currently admit. In fact, the other day in the Israeli parliament, the opposition was questioning the government on why they are arming and funding these ISIS-linked gangs inside Gaza to fight Hamas. So now that they couldn't defeat Hamas through with their most advanced military, they are now arming and funding ISIS-linked criminal gangs inside Gaza to fight Hamas. And this is the level they are actually aligned with ISIS. When they say that every accusation is a confession, it is actually true. It's not Hamas that is ISIS. Israel is ISIS. If you look at Israel's conduct, it is indeed one that has been aligned with ISIS in the region on many sort of like operations, including the regime change operation in Syria, and now the funding of these criminal gangs, who are the ones who are actually robbing the aid, and they're saying that Hamas is doing that, but they failed. Their military failed in containing Hamas, and now they are doing all this dirty work of arming and funding ISIS-linked gangs.
Yeah, I want to I guess take it back just like half a step as well, because I just read your recent article, Jeremy, around some of the ways in which this is being justified, like from a Western perspective, I guess, in regards to right to protect, responsibility to protect, sorry, and humanitarian language, because this is a significant thread, and I think we're going to see it popping up pretty soon, in regards to Iran with women's rights, and other human rights accusations against Iran, if things really kick off here. Can you give us a little bit of a primer as to how that works and develops?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you can go back to the end of the Cold War, and I think one of the most shocking elements of what is happening today and what has been happening over the last couple of years, and which the people of Gaza have been subject to most intensely, is just how comfortable people are with aerial bombardment, like mass aerial bombardment of urban centers, as if that is somehow a good way of waging war, humane war, humanitarian war. And the roots of that do go back to the 1990s, to the first Gulf War, which was represented as a surgical war, and then where we saw, the smart bombs emerging as a talking point for saying, we can carry out wars very precisely and targeting the baddies and not the civilian population, and do good in the world by using force. And that expanded through the NATO intervention in Bosnia and then Kosovo in the late 1990s. Those two cases being the only ones that might even have a vaguely plausible sort of outcome of where people could say, oh, something good came from it. I don't like that. I think that that's a dangerous way of thinking, but I think that those are the only two cases where you could at least, make the case for saying that these bombardment campaigns actually achieved something that they intended to achieve. But then once you get into the 2000s, the war on terror, Afghanistan, Iraq again, the use of drones in Sudan and sorry, Somalia, Pakistan, Libya in 2011, then the Syrian war over that period since 2011, people just became really comfortable with the total annihilation of neighborhoods by aerial bombardment, and they associated it, I think, with that kind of humane and humanitarian war. We know that Israel has continued to try and justify itself in that way, even as we see what they have done to Gaza, the amount of destruction that has been carried out there. They still talk about precision. They still talk about most moral army. They still talk about humanitarian zones, and there's all of this kind of humanitarian rhetoric that surrounds war fighting. And I saw yesterday in Netanyahu's speech, he said, it's time for the Iranian people to rise up against their oppressors. And so that's kind of, you're right, that is going to become a part of this. And I'm seeing strands of that in social media discussions as well. It's like, oh, well, there's nothing, or we might not agree with how this is happening, but it's actually good that that the Iranian regime is being destabilized. So that's all, that thread is runs right through. People have been made to feel very comfortable about that. People who, and I think people in Tel Aviv are experiencing this morning. If there was a single missile that was fired into your city, into Auckland, into Christchurch, any of these places, you would feel terrorized, even if it was nowhere near you, and even if you knew that that was the only missile that was going to hit your city. So imagine what it's like living in a situation where that is constant. That is terrorism. That is the purpose of it. And, we need to feel less comfortable with that. We need to learn to feel less comfortable with this form of war. I think with war in general, I think we've completely lost that, and it's been a consequence of the association of war with humanitarianism and democracy and human rights and freedom over the last 30 years that's brought us to this point.
Yeah, you still hear people saying, oh, I don't agree what happened in Iraq, but Saddam had to go, right? And like, even with everything that we know about what happened there, even with the deaths that stacked up both during that war and after that war, right? Even with the massive destabilization that Iraq now faces, oh, but Saddam was a bad guy, like it's such an out of hand justification for these just enormously destructive sets of atrocities. It's worrying to me whenever I see that thread begin to be introduced this early on, because that says to me they're going to do a fair bit more, and they want a range of justifications, and they know that just, oh, it's a preemptive strike to protect ourselves is not going to cut it.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up that, the thread of, making people comfortable with military action against certain countries. This is in fact one of the key, functions of the propaganda of the West, is to prime people to accept military action against certain countries. And the West has been, being fed this narrative about Iran for so long. With Bush, I think that he called it the dual containment or something, Iraq and Iran. Then we get the narrative of the axis of evil, Iran being always demonized, and any issue, any small protests that happen in Iran or any other countries that are identified as the West's enemies are being hyper-sensationalized in Western media. And when the people in those countries, for example, Iran, there have been so many protests against Western sanctions, which are, making the people suffer in Iran for so long, for so many years, more than decades now, including sanctions on medicines, right? And I remember during COVID, Iranian diplomats and Iranian people, saying, please lift the sanctions on the medical equipment and medicines. We need to, address this crisis. And the West didn't do anything. In fact, it kept reimposing sanctions again and again. And so Iran has been made into this pariah. And it's really interesting, Jeremy, that we're already seeing these indications that people are normalizing this. Okay, it's primed for regime change. And again, reminding me of Edward Said, the Orientalist construction of these governments and these people and these cultures. I remember during that protest, women right life freedom protest in Iran, how New Zealand media was portraying Iran, like every segment in the news media, they will show Iran. They will put this very weird, eerie music on Iran. Like, so it's like th this is how they build this kind of thinking among the Western working class and Western common people, ordinary people here, that oh, this is a dangerous place. But anyone who's traveled to Iran, they'll know that this is a wonderful place. Wonderful culture, such an ancient culture. This entire region currently being desecrated by Israel is such a beautiful, historical center of the world, cultural, educational center of the world. It is, the root of so many things we have now, right? Mathematical, advancements, astronomy, all these things, and it's just being desecrated by the West for so many years. And I want to also talk about the history of Iran and the history of, Western intervention in Iran. This is not happening, since 1979, since the Islamic Revolution. It has a longer history behind that, right? During the colonial period, for example, even though Iran was not directly colonized, it was in fact under the control. For example, the British East India Company had huge control on the trade. In and out of Iran, they monopolized certain key sectors like tobacco and oil, right? So from the early 20th century, oil in Iran is monopolized by a British corporation called Anglo-Persian Oil. And then in 1951, when they have an election, they get a democratic leader who has a plan of nationalizing the oil reserves and oil resources of Iran, saying that actually, our people, the working class in this country, are impoverished despite the fact that we have these resources. Let's nationalize them and let's use them so that the poverty, and the needs of the people are addressed first and foremost. We see the Operation Ajax come into play, right? This is an operation, orchestrated by CIA and the British intelligence, and they have a coup against Mossadegh, and they install this puppet regime called, the Shah regime, the monarchists, who are now again, after Israel attacked civilian areas in Iran, this prince of the Shah regime is coming out and stating support for this Israeli action. So there is a section in the Iranian bourgeoisie who support Israel, who support the Gaza genocide. This is a section of the Iranian bourgeoisie who are royalists. They are, to for lack of a better word, simps of the West. They are racist and Islamophobic, right? And so this section of the Iranian bourgeoisie are looking at this as an opportunity to come back into power. And ultimately, what Israel is doing right now is trying to create a regime change in Iran. So, one more thing is that, in 53, the coup happens, and then we get, a few decades, couple of decades, more than 2 decades of repressive rule, anti-democratic rule, anti-worker rule of the Iranian monarch, the Shah. And then it was against this repressive rule where freedom, there was no freedom, political freedoms, and also the working class were being really exploited. The wealth of Iran was being shipped out to Western oil corporations. And so the people were unhappy with this. And that is what led to the Islamic Revolution in 79. And I just want to also add one more thing is that actually in this revolution, it was a lot of it was driven by left-wing forces, but because of the repression of the Shah rule, a lot of the organizing was happening in a clandestine fashion, and the only places where they could organize was inside the mosques. That's where the Shah's police couldn't come in. And this is kind of one of the reasons why this revolution gets its religious flavor. So we must always remember the impact of Western colonialism, its imperialist control over the region, especially because it's so strategically important, because it's one of the most resource-rich regions in the world. That's probably one of the reasons why Islam is one of the most vilified religions, is because a lot of this Muslim dominant regions are sitting in these strategically important locations. Just some things for people to think about when they analyze this issue.
I think one thing that I've been thinking a lot about in the last 24 hours is Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states and what this means for them. Because I think that on Trump's travels, where he went to Saudi and to the UAE and Qatar, I think the fact that he didn't go to Israel at that time was probably one of the conditions for them meeting with him on that trip. So, there is now a huge divide between those Gulf states and Israel. I think for the Emirates, it's not so much an issue because they're small and they don't have the same kind of political currents that run through the population as the Saudis have. So the position of Saudi Arabia in relation to this, of Jordan, has already been talk about Jordan, participating in shooting down drones or at least making airspace open to Israeli fighter jets, and American support to bring down missiles and drones. So I don't know how tenable it is for these countries anymore. And I don't know if the calculus is the same for the Saudis now as it has been in the past. And so that's a real wild card, I think, is how does Saudi Arabia react to this potentially going to do massive destruction to their capacity to ship oil, to make money, and if it gets worse, then every chance that they get drawn into it in some way. The idea that they fight on the side of the United States and Israel just seems completely implausible at this time. That they remain neutral also seems kind of implausible. So you have Saudi Arabia, you have Turkey. There are a range of forces that are not like openly declared necessarily against Israel, but could very easily come into play at some point if this starts to spiral further out of control.
Yeah, this is why, like, right from, no, not even right from this instance, right, but from the last time, which was in like 12 months ago, when Israel just unilaterally, air quotes on unilaterally, attacked Iran. You can only read this as an attempt to start a wider war. It is, I guess, there's an argument to be made that they are just so arrogant and so comfortable with the shelter given them by the United States that they feel like there will be no consequences. But as far as we can see in the rhetoric this time around, which was not apparent in the last series of attacks, Netanyahu and others have been saying these attacks are going to continue to happen until the threat to our existence is removed. That's and that just kind of got swept away. I saw that posted once, in the live updates. But that's an incredible admission and indication of what Israel is planning to do here, and what the United States presumably is green lighting here.
Well, look at
That's
the last paragraph of Trump's Truth Social post. Iran must make a deal before there is nothing left and save what was once known as the Iranian Empire. I mean,
fucking
what?
hell. I mean, this is what I
Yeah.
mean though, right? Like this is a clear attempt to start maybe not even just a regional war, whatever euphemism we're using around the Middle East currently, but a world war. Because once you get some of these states involved, which are very, very key geopolitically in terms of resource movement, in terms of, even things like flights, alongside this shift in Western politics around militarization. So places like the UK saying we need to be war ready. We're putting 5% more of our GDP into the military. Even here in New Zealand, right? We're saying, oh, we're giving ourselves a like 2 point something boost to defense spending. There is an understanding among politicians of the West that we're going to be engaged in a wider conflict. I have no other way to read it at this point. And the inability of, or the intentional elision of that by whoever's analyzing this, by Western news reporters, but even more widely by, like, I mean, Al Jazeera is not really talking about the chances of this specifically either, is just lunacy to me. Like, this is what is happening. Like, why else do you think people are countries are starting to pour money into the military, trying to, like, there's been talk in Germany about possible conscription and stuff like that. Like, this doesn't happen in a vacuum. They're not doing this for fun. It's not just like, oh yes, we're just gonna do some hard talk, right? Like, this is the big one's coming, and we're gonna be there fighting in it. And the inability to even mention that, to even think about it, that really worries me.
Yeah, I mean, in some way, I think when people have repeatedly said, "Oh, could this be the start of World War III?" That's something that it's not just applicable yesterday. People have been saying that for a long time, and I think I've thought for a long time that, well, for people in Afghanistan, for people in Iran, for people in Iraq, for people in Syria, in Lebanon, in Palestine. This has been World War III for the last 20 years, 25 years, longer even for some of them, 30 years for, Afghanistan, Iraq in particular. So in a sense, it's all part of the, when we talk about it becoming a wider war, Israel has, and the United States, I think, always understood destabilization, regime change in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, as being a part of this process leading up to an attack on Iran. So, in that sense, it's not something that perhaps we should be surprised about. That this has been written about in plans and spoken about by political leaders and military leaders in the US and Israel for a very long time, that they've understood this kind of domino effect. I don't think it's played out in the way that they had hoped. It's been a lot more expensive and a lot more sort of fruitless, but there is that long-running thread in Israeli sort of military thinking that we keep all of these states balkanized, Syria, Iraq, and make sure that there's these ongoing wars taking place all around us, and that's the way in which we survive. I think it's just insane thinking, and I think that the reality of it is coming home to roost for Israel now. The idea that you can continue to survive and exist by continually bombing your neighbors is just crazy thinking for such a tiny state with such a tiny population. Oh yes, they've won wars in 67, 73, very, great victories over much larger rivals. That is not something that you can continue to do. It's not going to continue.
And it's
There will be a
relied.
point at which that becomes impossible.
Yeah. And it's relied not just on the US, right, but on the moderation of the people that they're bombing. It's and we saw that with the previous attack on Iran as well, right? Iran sent one set of missiles back and like, okay, that's done. They may do the same here, but probably not if Israel continues to attack. Simone, you've been quiet today. What are your thoughts?
Oh, I had thoughts about like three subjects ago, but I don't know if I have anything to contribute for this bit. Other than that, I just think Iran should have had nukes. It's a shame they didn't get them. That would have been the smarter thing, I think, actually.
Just in terms of deterrence.
I mean, if the world is going to have mad, you know, and you've got enemies that are as bloodthirsty and irrational as Israel, probably that was the smarter thing to do. They should have never signed the Iran deal with Obama. Because
I think
nobody,
that.
it's been memory hold already. Nobody respects it. Nobody remembers that. Doesn't matter. It was irrelevant.
I think that's another one of those threads which is like really important to keep in mind, right? Is the ways in which countries like Iran have acted in good faith with Western hegemony and just been ultimately punished for it again and again and again for not respecting the bloodthirstiness of their opponents, essentially, which is horrific to think about, but also, and I think you're on last time in regards to this topic, Jeremy. The norms which are currently being taken apart by Israel are just going to lead to situations where people that the West sees as bad actors now have the gloves off, right? So the previous really, I don't know if important is the right word, but I'll just use it, is the pager attack, right, in Lebanon. Like absolutely like clear-cut case of wide-scale terrorism by the Israeli state against civilians attacking the production line for civilian goods. What do you think happens now? Like, what do you think happens when you ignore the fact that it talks, that you ignore the fact that people were trying to act in good faith, that you just cast away, you know, and this is a constant lament on the podcast as well, but the rules-based international order, these things which have protected Western power for so long, these norms that have been used to attack, control, and ultimately dehumanize the enemies of the West. Actually, that was all pretense, it's all theater. You do what you got to do. Everyone's celebrating Israelis' technical genius, right? Like.
Well, they're trying to hold on to it. I mean, you can see in the statements from Germany and others that they still try and allude to this idea somehow that Israel, that Iran was breaching international law and therefore this was perfectly legal on the part of Israel. But they've been hoist on by their own petard on this one, particularly in relation to the big show about talking about the illegality of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Fine, yeah, okay, so. Where are we with that now? I mean, I said to people after the US and others, the Europeans were green lighting the Gaza genocide, like in the early days, that this is terrible for Ukraine. Like if you care about Ukraine, this is something that's going to have repercussions for Ukraine because, as you say, other powers are like, why should we respect these rules? Like you're not even
Yeah.
they're not even doing a good job of pretending to care about these rules. Like it's wild how hypocritical, you know, people talk about gaslighting. I mean, this is beyond industrial scale gaslighting. This is like global scale denial of basic decency and basic respect for rules which you claim to represent and that you claim to be upholding. I mean, people just aren't going to put up with that forever. You can't do that. We're being treated like idiots, honestly. I don't know. I don't think it's holding up.
What
I
was it
think
that
where
Vimp
Germany
said?
says, sorry, go
Anarchy
ahead.
is what states make of it.
Well, yeah, I know, but I don't even know what that means at the moment. Like, what does anarchy mean at the moment in international politics? I wonder who they're speaking to, like the German Foreign Ministry and others. What is it? 5, 10% of people who might still be buying into that stuff? Most people don't think this is credible anymore. So I just don't know what they're speaking to, what they're appealing to, how they can continue to talk about the rules-based order. You know, we do it here in New Zealand still as well. It makes very little sense. But yeah, that's kind of where we are right now.
All right, everyone. So how do we solve it?
There's nothing so rank, I think, as someone like the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz saying, oh, it's because of all these immigrants that we have an anti-Semitism problem in Germany. His grandfather was a Nazi. His father was a member of the CDU when West Germany existed. He was an anti-communist activist in the 1970s. To lay the European crime, the specifically, uniquely almost German crime of the Holocaust at the feet of, Turkish migrants coming into Germany to find work is despicable, really. And this kind of Holocaust denial on the part of Germany becomes a part of its manufacturing of consent for the Holocaust in Gaza today. I think about there's the section, Jeremy, of your more recent article that Carl was sending around. It says the nihilism of war cannot be logically or practically accommodated within universal humanitarian values without debasing and perverting the meaning of humanity. And that, I think, is really the crux of it, this notion of responsibility to protect of R2P, if that is still a thing that anybody talks about, or perhaps the notion of a liberal international rules-based order at all, is one in which these contradictions have become so heightened that I think one of them was always going to win out over the other. And it's the violent one, right? That if you are trying to marry humanitarianism with war, that war will always dominate over it. But this is a kind of justification which has long existed. We remember that, Hitler's invasion of Czechoslovakia was predicated upon the idea that it was a humanitarian intervention. This has always been the case with these. And I think it is showing it to be a farce, yes. Where do we go from here as a question is something which I'm not sure. I think about another section of your article, this means the use of force by the powerful against the weak is baked into the framework. And this was something that was flagged up by the International Court of Justice in the Corfu Channel case, one of its first substantive cases in the early 1950s, that, if there isn't some kind of meaningful rules-based order, or rather some kind of agreement that there is a level playing field when it comes to norms and values at the international level, then it does become the maximum of Thucydides. The strong do as they will and the weak do as they must, that there is this kind of might makes right to it. And New Zealand has a choice to make in respect of that, that if we want to present ourselves as being, oh, we were one of the founding members of the United Nations, New Zealand respects, is a small nation punching above its weight in terms of respecting, international law and all of these kinds of national mythologies and pieces of propaganda around the New Zealand state that it disseminates to its own citizenry, in particular its professional class getting a liberal humanities education at the university, then I think it's incumbent upon a country which makes those claims not to make a farce of itself. And we have to decouple from the United States. How can it be possible that we can have any kind of military, give any kind of military or diplomatic or trade succor to a state which is carrying out just a
Genocide.
contemporary, yeah, a contemporary Holocaust, a genocide, right? And not only that, but I think, the kind of Cold War, because the justification during the Cold War was always anti-communism, and R2P arises to kind of justify the continued existence of NATO, which no longer had a raison d'être, right? This kind of what was originally a Nazi make-work program following Operation Paperclip. And I think it's worth thinking about how that kind of sudden shift it was shown to be ridiculous on its face immediately, because the invasion of Iraq was, again, the Nuremberg crime, right? It was the crime of aggression, the supreme international crime, containing within it every other crime, as that court had said. And I think it's worth considering whether or not New Zealand, it's almost too late, but whether or not New Zealand might do at the bare minimum something that shows that there is an ounce of humanity when we see blown bodies come up on our social media feeds.
I like that thought, Simone, but I was watching Jacinda Ardern on a podcast yesterday called
Oh, I'm
Cord
sorry
Save
for you,
America.
Josephine.
And
What did you learn
what
about kindness, Josephine?
but there was a question about Gaza, something that, she's been avoiding for a long time. And you know what she ended up saying? She ended up praising the national government's position. She said, whether it's national or Labour, we are similar to Ireland, she said, New Zealand's approach to Gaza. In Ireland, the Israeli embassy was closed. Ireland. We're not in any way, similar to Ireland in our approach to Palestine and Israel. But effectively, what Ardern did was give a free pass to the current government, and in fact, even show some support to its policies. And she all obviously supported that, that paper tiger, the recent sanctioning of two travel ban on two individuals within the Israeli government. And so that's what our country is at. That's the position, whether it's Labour or National. Next elections, I do think that this government is going to be a one-term government. I mean, the price, if you go to the supermarkets, the prices are still going up. The people will vote, on the basis of their material conditions as well. And I think that, Labour might come up, but we cannot be very hopeful. The last Labour government took New Zealand closer to NATO. And like you said, NATO's history, Simone, is, drenched in blood. It was a, laundering mechanism for a lot of rehabilitating a lot of Nazis from Germany in its, leadership of NATO. So, NATO is not a force for peace in the world. It is a destabilizing force. And we can see how all the NATO countries are responding to the genocide in Gaza. This recent travel ban on these two individuals. In fact, I think New Zealand is giving a free pass to Zionism and Israel, the state of Israel, by saying that what Israel is doing is not a problem. As long as they don't say that it's a genocide, it's okay. So why is it that New Zealand only punishes these individuals when it is the state, the Israeli state, Netanyahu and his army, his genocide army, committing all these war crimes in front of our bare eyes? Sorry, New Zealand cannot, sanction Israel yet. So I don't really have much hope there, but I do have hope on one aspect. That is, the public opinion in these countries. And recently there was a poll in the United States which showed that for the first time since the inception of Israel, the favorability rating for Israel is below 50%. It's sitting at 42% or something public approve of Israel. So I feel like this has some impact on these Western governments, and they might still be aligned with the United States. I mean, if in the next election someone like Pete Buttigieg or AOC comes to power, what they will effectively do is save the US empire, right? As long as Trump exists, the US empire is accelerating into its decline. But if next election someone like AOC comes into power, they will ultimately, what they will be doing is they'll give a lifeline to the empire. They'll give legitimacy to the empire. So it might come to a point where Israel doesn't have any more, any more viability because its backers cut ties with it. But whether it is going to be, a death knell on U.S. imperialism is something to be seen. But I do think that Israel is making its future increasingly untenable. I think that we in the, in Western countries, we need to start making the connection between what's going on in Gaza and our own everyday lives. In the United States, for example, this company called Palantir, which has worked with the Israeli, army, the AI and technology provided, they've provided services to the genocide army. They are now in a tie-up with the Trump government, and they are going to be embedded in the United States sort of government systems. And it's really a threat to whatever democratic values people believe in, the value of free speech, of having opposition to, for example, the state and so forth. The plan that Palantir has is to unify the data in various US government departments, so it's easily available for the government to deploy in case of terrorism. Obviously, that's always what they say. And this kind of move towards a technocracy based on AI is really, really becoming a threat within Western countries. We can also see, for example, the companies profiting from the genocide, for example, BlackRock. We have a $2 billion deal with them, and BlackRock is known to lobby for reducing the sorry increasing the pension age, and they have been lobbying for this in different parts of the world. They are lobbying for the privatization of public services. So what which these corporations, which are profiting from the genocide, are also a threat to working class people's rights in the West. So as long as we are aware that of our connections with this genocide, and we continue to show our disapproval of what's going on in Gaza, I think there will be a breaking point. Just want to say this last thing. In the final years of, this is from Vincent Bevins, who wrote that incredible book about Indonesia, what happened to the communists. There was a CIA operation which basically, killed hundreds of thousands of people there. So Vincent Bevins, what was the name of that book? Does someone remember?
Jakarta Method?
Jakarta Method, yeah.
Yes, that's it. So Vincent Bevins reminds us that in the final years of South African apartheid, the white government decided it must overthrow the government of Angola, install a puppet regime in Namibia, attack Zimbabwe, attack Botswana, attack Zambia in order to survive. This did not eventually work out, and the apartheid regime fell. So, let's keep our voices loud and show that we cannot accept this. And when the Western sponsors cut their ties with Israel, that's when Israel's lifeline, is cut or destroyed, and it becomes untenable for Israel to continue. And that's my hope.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the United States is in a state of terminal decline. I think we haven't even talked about what's been happening in the United States over the last couple of months, where, we're seeing these running battles between people on the streets and police, where, there's violence against political leaders being, and I think with the sort of, I've read bits from that Trump statement from last night. I don't know how anyone in the United States, anyone in Riyadh, in Saudi Arabia, can read that and think that this is not a person who will go to sink to any depth, that will go to any length to use the tools of force available to him to do whatever whimsical thing he wants to achieve on any particular day. And we know that that's what he wants to achieve is generally going to be driven by avarice and racism, and yeah, that's happening internationally and it's happening domestically. I don't see a way back for the United States. Even I think that people in New Zealand and Australia and elsewhere, I'm hearing these reassuring platitudes of like, oh, well, it's an electoral cycle. I spoke to someone who did public diplomacy for NATO who said this as well. It's like, how do you come here and talk about, promoting human rights and democracy when the lead player in your alliance is denouncing these things like openly and acting against them? It's like, well, it's an electoral cycle. Things will go back to normal once the next election takes place in the US. I speak to fewer and fewer people who believe that. But that's the reassurance that people are giving themselves within government and diplomatic circles at the moment, as far as I've observed, that this is just a blip. And that's just a total misread of history. It's a neglect of everything that's happened in the context of the post-September 11 world, in the context of the post-Cold War world, that this is not a blip. This is the trajectory that the US has been on for that period. You could go back into the Cold War, the people of Vietnam, the people of Korea will Laos and Cambodia, they know this. They experience this. This is not something that's fresh and new and never experienced before. But it does. Doesn't appear to be a way back for the United States. And so the question of, well, how do we go about changing it? It takes courageous leadership, and we're not seeing that really from anywhere much in the world at the moment. I thought that that move by the UK and Canada and New Zealand to impose sanctions might have been a sign that things were changing, but clearly the response to this attack on Iran shows that that was not the case. That there hasn't really been a fundamental change in any of their thinking about this stuff. So there's not no one's taking a lead apart from countries, trying to exercise the levers of international law, like South Africa with the ICJ case. So I don't think we can expect that. And it's always been the case that when, you talk about momentous changes in international politics, that they come about after periods of major violence. And nobody wants to see that happen. But that appears to be where we will continue to head, in the days, hours, days, weeks, months, years, to come. And at some point, people will try and call a halt to it, and some kind of new order is going to emerge from that. I don't think anyone can really predict what that's going to look like. I hope. I saw Greta Thunberg the other day when she was asked, well, why do we keep ignoring Gaza? She said, it's racism. And she's right. She's completely right that it's driven by racism, a belief that those people are expendable, that they deserve to die, that they're associated with terrorism. I hope we can rebuild a world in which we don't think that these things are driven by religion. Whether it is Judaism or Islam, religion is, to me, not the primary issue of concern here. That is not what is driving what is going on. And the fact that we dwell on religion is very, very much tied to racism. And I hate to see it, but I'm seeing it more and more in the way people express themselves about Israel and the way in which they express themselves about Arabs, people and Muslims. People lump Iranians in with Arabs, and they don't understand the distinction. It's always been the case, but it's quite obvious now on social media that people don't really understand what Iran is. So something will emerge from the ashes. I hope the ashes are not too deep, and I hope what emerges from it is better than what we've had. And we need to speak, contribute to the process that leads to creation of something better from those ashes. That's all we can do. And so I guess we need to keep trying.
Yeah, League of Nations 3, let's go.
League of
That's not
Nations
what I
3?
said.
Well, the UN is League of Nations 2 Electric Boogaloo, right? Like, this is not what's okay. Maybe I'm wrong. I agree. Yeah, no, Cuba, you have the chance to do something good once again, just like you did in Africa. Fund the insurgency, baby. I have to sort of agree in that I think it's almost too late for any sort of conception of the post-war liberal international rules-based order to even be salvaged, rhetorically, I mean, not in terms of reality. I don't think it ever existed, but it's curious that even people who normally would be the kind of handmaidens to power on this, people even in diplomacy, I mean, we've seen diplomats quitting their jobs over this. This is not something that happened nearly so much in the Cold War. People might defect to the other side, but not necessarily just be disgusted with the entire thing, right? So I think I basically already said before what I think New Zealand should consider, which is consider its options and really think about what it ought to do. And as for us, I mean, I think, Josephine, you brought up something really pertinent, which is that our instrument for registering public opinion is supposed to be elections, but I'm not certain what the roots for that would be here. Labour and National agree on this. MMP is almost always going to have those parties as one of the main parties. The Greens never want to use their leverage for anything. It might be Te Pāti Māori, but that's only one small little party in Parliament. And as for extra parliamentary action, we've had these rallies which have had almost no effect on the governments of New Zealand, the successive ones. Hipkins, who had just a disgusting position on Gaza continues to hold the seat of power within Labour. It's an open question as to whether or not there can be any sort of organisation within this country to reflect public opinion through instruments of political power, I think, to have any kind of organised resistance to repression elsewhere and also domestically in relation to Israel. So it's an open question. That's all I know.
It's a really difficult question to answer. I just want to say, in the meantime, that we need to be kind of alert not to become pawns of empire. By this, I mean, be alert when we hear narratives, for example, all the fear mongering about China. They are priming us for a military action against China. Similarly, you know, in the last so many years, Iran has been demonized. And I see New Zealand's left even participating in those demonization efforts. The Green Party, for example, you know, demanding in parliament that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard be sanctioned. I remember on the steps of Parliament, Green Party joining hands with the likes of Jerry Brownlee, demanding that New Zealand sanction Iran effectively. But we've never seen them say that about, for example, the US police, who kill over 1,000 people every year. So at that moment, I feel the Green Party was inadvertently, or I don't know, knowingly, a pawn of empire, priming us to say, okay, these attacks on Iranian national leaders, or this is normal, it's fine, it's they are an evil regime who deserve to be removed. So this is that colonial propaganda in action, and just being a little bit more critical of Western schemes to justify regime change.
Yeah, I think one of the key pieces of PR or propaganda around that is just to understand that an appeal to shared values is a dehumanization tactic against the people that you don't share values with. And that's just something like all of us can keep an eye on, because it's really easy to just be getting some of that by osmosis. Even if that's just by seeing atrocity footage like every fucking day, remembering that these aren't just bodies, right? Like that these aren't just like things that have been acted upon. You know, these are real people. These are real societies. And understanding deeply what is being done a lot of the time in our name as people living in the West. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you, Josephine and Simone, my co-hosts.
Thanks, Kyle.
And thank you for joining us to guest once again, Jeremy.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to talk it out.
Sometimes that's what you need as well.
Sometimes it's what you need.
Thank you to everyone who's listened. Thank you to our audience. You're not going to get this kind of content almost anywhere else. So let people know that there's media out there that is actually trying to grapple with these issues, that is not drenched in propaganda. Share it around. Get other people talking about it. Have your own little chats with your friends and neighbors. And think about how you can act to start shifting the dial on some of this stuff, with the understanding that sometimes electoralism isn't going to cut it. That's been another episode of One of 200. We'll catch you next time.
If artifices are denied, live in a pointless life, but learn in all your lessons. Fucking politics, there's no distinction. The road's far now, it's paved with good intentions. And I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they criticize across me or to stay. Cause I live amongst the people every day in this vindictive, forgetful fucking race.